responsibilities at home. The cohesive family environment stemming from this emphasis on motherhood creates a level of social stability that would be the envy of most Western countries. Indeed, the Middle East suffers less random crime and violence than the industrialized world, in large measure thanks to the devotion of women to their families. However, Jordanian women who choose to pursue a professional career are free to do so. Indeed, I have worked with many highly qualified and impressive women in my office and throughout the region. There were inequities, too, to be sure. We were particularly concerned about our inability to remove the outrageous and legally protected practice of honor crimes from Jordan's penal code, which essentially gave men license to kill wives or sisters or daughters whom they accused of having had illicit sexual relations, with little fear of legal consequence. For all the progress Jordan had made in terms of democracy and human rights, our Article 340 remained in place. He who discovers his wife or one of his female relatives committing adultery and kills, wounds, or injures one of them is exempted from any penalty. There were around 25 such killings a year in Jordan, and many more in other countries around the world. Crimes of passion are sanctioned in many countries, but we recognized our responsibility to advocate for changes in the penal code. King Hussein condemned violence against women in his 1997 opening address to Parliament, but for all our efforts, the elected members of the Jordanian Parliament voted time and again to retain the statute. There was a simple lack of political will. Despite the Constitution and the religious law known as Sharia, both of which are patently opposed to the so-called honor killings and forbid the taking of the law into one's own hands. The Jordanian journalist Rana Hosseini almost single-handedly brought this problem to the attention of the public in a series of newspaper articles over a 9-year period. Many criticized her work and motives, and some of her detractors even sent hate mail and threats. But Rana persisted. "I kept on going because I knew what I was doing was the right thing, and that it did not contradict Sharia or the principles of human rights," she told me. Her achievements were given special recognition when she was awarded the Reebok Human Rights Award in 1998. I was also concerned about women's and human rights issues in other regions of the world, specifically the suffering of women in Bosnia. Jordan had been providing refuge for almost 100 Bosnian refugee families since the outset of the war in 1993, but shockingly little international attention had been focused on the steady stream of Muslim refugees forced from their homes by the Serbian government's policy of ethnic cleansing. Jacques Chirac, the president of France, was particularly incensed at the indifference shown by Europe and the United States, and had spoken to me on an official visit to France about what we might do to focus attention on the problem. I contacted other first ladies and heads of state to urge collective support and to increase relief assistance. Jordan sent plane loads of food, blankets, medical supplies, and reconstruction equipment to Bosnia, and in July 1996, I traveled to Tuzla to meet with Swanee Hunt, the U.S. ambassador to Austria, and founder of the global movement Women Waging Peace, and Italian-European Commissioner Emma Bonino, my co-chairs of the Women of Srebrenica project. In Tuzla, 30,000 survivors of Srebrenica were living in temporary, ill-equipped refugee camps, most of them Muslim women whose husbands and sons had disappeared in the carnage. We met with the refugee women in a huge gym. Many were desperate to know the fate of their missing men and boys, and to have those responsible brought to justice. The vast majority of the people collected in the hall were grieving widows, many of whom became increasingly hysterical during the event. At one point, as their moans of grief reached a crescendo, I went up to the stage and was able to calm them somewhat with prayers from the Quran. What could one possibly say in the face of such loss, of such crimes against humanity? The women had hung on the walls and the rails of the stadium thousands of pieces of cloth embroidered with the names of 7,000 missing men and boys. The organizers had even invited Serb and Croat women who had suffered their own losses to join them in commemorating the fall of Srebrenica the year before. "We are all mothers," they explained. The organizers of the ceremony in Tuzla subsequently toured with the commemorative banner and used the occasion to raise hundreds of thousands of dollars to help the women of Srebrenica rebuild their shattered lives. 5 years later, I would return to Bosnia as a member of the International Commission on Missing Persons, ICMP, created in 1996 at the G7 summit in Lyon, France, and meet with many of the same women. They were still searching for news of their loved ones, unable to rebuild their lives without this knowledge, and without assurances that the massacre would be officially memorialized. While the ICMP's state-of-the-art DNA technology has been successful in speeding up identification of remains from mass graves throughout the Balkans, it was also used to assist with identification efforts at New York's World Trade Center site following September 11, 2001. And while our work with family associations has given these women new hope, it has become painfully clear that conflict recovery and reconciliation in the Balkans will take many years. In 1996, women in Jordan, Palestine, and Lebanon also continued to suffer the consequences of war and upheaval, particularly those women of Palestinian origin, who, like the women of Srebrenica, longed to return home. Sadly, that summer the possibility of a Palestinian homecoming seemed to grow ever more remote. Jordan's peace with Israel had become increasingly strained after the election of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Only 2 months after he took office, Netanyahu announced that he was lifting the 4-year freeze on the expansion of Jewish settlements on the West Bank that was called for in the Oslo agreements. To our horror, he approved the construction of 2,000 new homes in the occupied Jordan Valley, an incendiary move that drew condemnation by the Arab League and a stern warning about our peace treaty from my husband. The warning fell on deaf ears. Netanyahu slowed the withdrawal of Israeli forces from Palestinian territory, called for in the Oslo Accords, to almost a trickle, including the planned redeployment of occupying troops from the city of Hebron, which was home to 130,000 Palestinians and only 500 Jews. The tension was palpable to everyone, it seemed, but Netanyahu's hardliners. The straw that finally broke the camel's back came only 3 months after Netanyahu took office, when Israel ran a new entrance to a tunnel into Arab East Jerusalem under the sacred Al-Aqsa Mosque. King Hussein was furious. The Israelis had not said a word to him in advance, even though a high-level emissary from Netanyahu's government had met with my husband just 24 hours earlier. Not only did this action symbolize the presumption of Israel's sovereignty over the entire city, it was also of special concern to my husband as the Hashemite custodian of the holy places in Jerusalem, a role underscored in our peace treaty. 54 Palestinians and 14 Israelis were killed in the 4 days of violence that followed in Jerusalem, and Jordan's peace treaty with Israel was almost another casualty. 38 Jordanian groups, including political parties and professional organizations, signed a statement condemning Jordan's normalization of relations with Israel. Disillusionment with the treaty was already deepening at all levels of Jordanian society. Israel had not delivered on the trade deals worked out during the pre-peace negotiations, and the peace dividends that so many had anticipated simply failed to materialize. One poll of Jordanians taken at the beginning of 1996 found that 47% felt the economy had actually deteriorated in the 2 years since my husband and Rabin signed the peace treaty. Our national debt was such that the International Monetary Fund ordered us to lift government subsidies on bread, leading to riots in Jordan during the summer of 1996. It was all so predictable and avoidable. To build peace, people must not have something worth fighting for, but something to make it worth ending the fighting. I said at an awards ceremony in the United States in the fall of 1996, where Leah Rabin and I were awarded the Eleanor Roosevelt Val Kill Medal for our work for peace. The peace process was deteriorating so rapidly that President Clinton invited King Hussein, Yasser Arafat, and Benjamin Netanyahu to an emergency meeting on October 2 at the White House. Hussein did not hold back in his face-to-face meeting with Netanyahu, and the King's list of Israeli transgressions was somehow leaked to Thomas Friedman at the New York Times. The illegal expropriation of Palestinian land for Jewish settlements, Israeli-imposed curfews on Palestinians that made it nearly impossible for them to work, the lack of a timetable for withdrawing Israeli troops from Hebron and starting negotiations on final status, the travesty of the tunnel, the counterproductiveness of Israel's fortress mentality, when the only real security would have to come from mutual respect. I speak for myself, for Yitzhak Rabin, a man whom I had the great pride to call my friend, and for all peoples who benefit from peace, King Hussein said to Netanyahu. All this goodwill is being lost. We are at the edge of the abyss, and regardless of our best efforts, we might be just about to fall into it. All of us. It was heartbreaking for us to watch all we had worked to build unraveling so quickly. But my husband was dealing with Netanyahu's right-wing ideology, which not only was uncompromising, but also often had no basis in fact. We were in London, returning from a visit to the United States during which many American Jewish leaders had expressed dismay over Netanyahu's approach, when Hussein received a call from the Israeli Prime Minister, who was in the United States, saying that he wanted to meet as soon as possible. He would cut short his U.S. trip to fly to London, apparently having been urged by his U.S. Jewish supporters to meet and repair relations with Hussein. I was in the shower the next evening when Prime Minister Netanyahu arrived. Our protocol officers had agreed with his people that he alone would be coming to the house, so I was startled to be informed that Mrs. Netanyahu had unexpectedly arrived with him. I came down to the sitting room with my hair half-dried, determined to be hospitable and entirely apolitical. However, in my inimitable way, I unintentionally stepped into a minefield. I was trying to stress the positive impact on both our societies, Arab and Israeli, of the institutional, business, and individual contacts that had developed between our peoples over the past several years. As part of the progress in the peace process, we had been very encouraged to see that Israel and Arab historians and scholars were reviewing textbooks and historical accounts with a view to correcting the propaganda on both sides. She immediately bristled. "What do you mean, propaganda?" she said. I replied that one example of a myth that had polarized our people was the description of Palestine in the 1940s as a land with no people for people with no land, when in fact generations of Palestinians had been living in Palestine for thousands of years. She bristled again. "What do you mean?" she said. "When the Jews came to this area, there were no Arabs here. They came to find work when we built cities. There was nothing here before that." "I am certain many of your own historians would agree that that is not accurate," I replied. It was quite an insight for me. Netanyahu was known for his conservative rigidity, but to hear an erroneous version of history stated so emphatically by his wife in private was truly alarming. Did they truly believe myths like this one? And if so, what other misconceptions might impede our working together for a lasting peace? After the Netanyahu meeting, we flew from London to Amman, and then drove to our new home, Bab el-Salam. For Hussein, the house was a refuge from the unrelenting stress and turmoil of the time. He loved the way many of the rooms on the first floor opened onto the terrace and lawn, which made the house light and natural, especially our family kitchen. He loved the small, cozy sitting room with its double-height fireplace, decorated by an exquisite mosaic I had commissioned from our School for Mosaic Arts in Madaba, and the two-story library that also opened onto a terrace. In the entrance hall and dining room, I hung his portrait, and those of various ancestors, including his father, King Talal, his grandfather, King Abdullah, and his great-grandfather, Sharif Hussein bin Ali. The house was not quite finished when we moved in. My office was not ready, and we had not started construction on the annex for the older children. So we all jammed in together, but Hussein enjoyed that as well, far preferring to be close to his children than separated by layers of floors, as we had been for so many years at Al Nadwa. My husband relished watching the garden develop. He loved fragrant plants such as orange blossom and jasmine, and I also focused on drought-resistant, low-maintenance plants. I loved palm trees and bougainvillea, favorites of mine since I had lived in Santa Monica, and put them wherever I could. We fertilized the organic vegetable and herb gardens with sheep manure, and attempted to keep them pest-free with a border of lavender and aubergines. He was particularly enthusiastic about the wooden ties from the old Hejaz railroad that we used to frame the raised beds, and he was curious about every step of the landscaping process. "What on earth are you doing?" he asked our gardener when he came home one day to find a cluster of people picking stones out of the lawn. Then he pitched in himself. Generally, I designed the garden to be as open as possible, so that all the children and grandchildren, who then already numbered 11, could join together and play games and sports freely. For all our happiness at Bab al-Salam, it seemed there was little peace elsewhere. Prime Minister Netanyahu and his government did finally follow through on the redeployment of Israeli troops from Hebron, but he immediately precipitated another crisis by approving the construction of 6,500 new Israeli housing units on 425 acres of expropriated Palestinian land on a hill between Jerusalem and Bethlehem. The provocation was as extraordinary as it was transparent. The land, which Palestinians call Jabal Abu Hunaim, or Green Mountain, and the Israelis renamed in Hebrew Har Homa, or Mountain of the Wall, had earlier been declared part of a protected green belt between Bethlehem and Jerusalem. But it had become the last link in Israel's ring of settlements around Arab East Jerusalem. Now the last remaining land corridor between Arab East Jerusalem and the occupied West Bank was to be eliminated, and the vast chain of commercial and fortress-like residential space would effectively tip the balance in Israel's favor in disputed Jerusalem, before the final status peace talks, should they ever take place. The announcement of the Har Homa project triggered increasingly violent demonstrations. "You cannot continue to humiliate a people without some reaction," my husband warned. Israel was condemned for its actions by the world community, with the exception of the United States, which responded by saying that the Clinton administration wished Israel would not build the settlement. But in March 1997, protected by helicopters and soldiers, Israeli bulldozers started their work anyway. The furor was such that the United Nations General Assembly held three emergency sessions, one charging that Israel was violating a provision of the Geneva Convention that prohibits the large-scale destruction of property, the others passing a resolution that the settlement was illegal and a major obstacle to peace. The only two votes against the resolution came from the United States and Israel. The 15 members of United Nations Security Council also addressed the issue of the settlement, with the same result. When the resolution declaring its illegality came to a vote, not once but twice, in March, 14 of the 15 member countries voted in support, while the United States vetoed the resolution both times. Just when things could not seem to get worse, they did. My husband and I were in Madrid on an official visit on March 13, when he received word that a Jordanian soldier had shot 7 Israeli schoolgirls to death and wounded 6 others on the Island of Peace at the Naharaim crossing point. Some of the wounded students were taken to nearby Shuna Hospital in the Jordan River Valley, where Jordanian farmers lined up in the hallways to give blood, saving at least one of them. But nothing could ease the anguish my husband felt as he immediately cancelled our trip and turned back to Jordan. I cannot offer enough condolences or express enough personal sorrow to the mothers, fathers, and brothers of these children who fell today, he said when he arrived. He then made an unprecedented visit to the Israeli village of Beit Shemesh 3 days later to offer his personal condolences to the stricken families. He insisted that his visits to each family be shown on Jordanian television, despite the fury he knew this would trigger among the extremist groups in Jordan. He wanted everyone to take note of the price of violence. And it was very moving to see him consoling the mothers. If there is any purpose in my life, it will be to make sure that all the children do not suffer the way our generation did, he said to one of the families. But the violence continued unabated. The bulldozers at the Har Homa settlement led to more and more clashes between stone-throwing Palestinians and Israeli soldiers shooting rubber bullets. Soon the violence spread through the West Bank and turned into riots in Ramallah. Israeli tanks moved in and surrounded villages on the West Bank. In retaliation, there were more suicide bombings during the summer, more senseless deaths. Even my husband's optimism was sorely tried by then. I know mine was. We both had trouble sleeping. The short-sighted approach of Netanyahu and the hardliners in his government had put terrific pressure on the king to reverse the peace process. Everything he had worked for all his life, every relationship he had painstakingly built on trust and respect, every dream of peace and prosperity he had had for Jordan's children, was turning into a nightmare. I really did not know how much more Hussein could take. Chapter 20. The White Bird. Toward the end of 1997, my husband started suffering from the occasional night fever. Our medical team in Jordan gave him a battery of tests, but could not find anything. They treated him with antibiotics, which stopped the fevers for a time. Then they would return. The doctors suspected that the fevers were due to some sort of mysterious virus. More than that, they could not say. Half in jest, I started to call my husband's malady the Bibi virus, alluding to a bizarre bioterrorism episode that fall. In September 1997, agents from Mossad, Israel's intelligence agency, entered Jordan under forged Canadian passports and attempted to assassinate the head of the political bureau of Hamas, the main Islamist resistance movement in the Palestinian territories, formed after the eruption of the First Intifada in 1987. They injected the man, Khalid Mash'al, with a deadly chemical agent in broad daylight on the streets of Amman. That a government-sponsored terrorist attack would take place on Jordanian soil so soon after Jordan and Israel had signed a treaty deeply offended my husband. So did the fact that Khalid Mash'al was hovering near death in an Amman hospital, and the Netanyahu government was refusing to divulge which chemical agent had been used in the attack. It took the intervention of President Clinton to force Israel to identify the drug it had used, apparently a synthetic opiate called fentanyl, and what the antidote might be. The gravely ill Mash'al was treated and survived. The king was on the verge of cancelling the peace treaty with Israel when Netanyahu, whose nickname is Bibi, flew to Jordan in the middle of the night to try to mend fences. Hussein was so angry that he had refused to meet with the Israeli Prime Minister and asked Crown Prince Hassan to handle the contact. Though I teased about the Bibi virus, one could not help but wonder at times. It was impossible to ignore the fact that my husband was very popular in Israel. Many Israelis told us that they would gladly exchange Hussein for Bibi. Might it be politically expedient for Netanyahu to remove a credible, moderate Arab voice from the increasingly polarized region? Hussein's fevers continued on and off throughout the winter. During his annual checkup at the Mayo Clinic in May 1998, the medical staff came up with theories involving various obscure viruses, but they did not identify any other anomalies in his system. We left the clinic and headed for Washington, D.C., where Hussein met with President Clinton and Secretary of State Madeleine Albright to talk about re-energizing the stalled peace process. Then we went on to England for a week, where we celebrated our 20th wedding anniversary at Buckhurst Park. We had already celebrated our anniversary with all our Jordanian family and friends in Jordan the previous November. According to the Islamic calendar, our 20th year coincided exactly with Hussein's 62nd birthday. So we had combined the celebrations. We decided to mark the occasion again in England, with friends and family who had not been with us in November. And for those few days, Hussein seemed to have shaken the fevers and was happy and relaxed. The anniversary celebration took place on a beautiful, balmy evening, and the party seemed to invigorate him. In the series of photographs we took, my husband looks healthy and happy, surrounded by his children. Later, on our return to Jordan, his fevers returned, this time fiercer and more debilitating. His medical staff performed more tests, and this time they found some lab abnormalities that required further study. We decided to return to the Mayo Clinic. I will never forget the moment at the clinic when I was told my husband had cancer. I was in a private sitting room that the hospital had assigned to the children and me while Hussein underwent the exploratory surgery. After several hours, a familiar face entered the room. Dr. David Barrett, who had successfully operated on my husband in 1992, reported to our group that the surgery had gone very well and that Hussein was being moved into the recovery room. The children relaxed somewhat, and then Dr. Barrett and I stepped outside. In the hallway, he turned to me and said that tests had identified abnormal cells in several locations in my husband's body. He said he suspected non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. My mind could only take in so much. I remember standing there, seeing his lips move and dimly hearing his voice, while my mind raced at a million miles a minute, trying to process the information in a way that was not dreadful or hopeless. What brought me back to earth was Dr. Barrett's reaction to what he had to tell me. Tears were running down his cheeks as he fought to control his emotions. I ended up comforting him, and while I did, the seriousness of his news sunk in. If there were abnormal cells in multiple locations, did that mean that it might have advanced to the point where we might have only months, weeks, or days left? I could not breathe. Once he had left, a maelstrom of emotion washed over me. I walked over to a large picture window in the corridor to compose myself before returning to the children. Their father had come through the tests just fine, I told them. I would talk to them about the results, but first I had to go to the recovery room so I could be there when he came out of anesthesia. I tried just as hard to maintain my composure with our security and staff, and then with my husband, as he slowly regained consciousness. As always, he thanked everyone. Barely awake, he wanted to make sure that everyone else was all right and knew how much he appreciated their care. I had never lied to him, so suddenly I found myself in unfamiliar territory when he became clear-headed enough to ask, "Well, how did it go?" I mumbled, "The procedure went well, Sidi," as I struggled to keep my face from trembling and tears from welling up in my eyes. "The doctors will have a meeting and tell us about everything," I said, stalling for time. The Mayo anesthesiologist, Jeff Wellner, was sitting at the end of the bed, and when my husband realized he was there, he greeted him. "What did you find?" he asked. "Your Majesty, we think it is lymphoma." My husband blinked hard, clearly startled by the news, while I sat there wishing he had had a few more hours to come out of the anesthesia before hearing the news. But he was always stronger than I. As we reached out to each other for a quick embrace, Hussein was already thinking ahead. "Okay, what do we do next?" Sidi moved back to his suite and settled in. While he did, I asked the children to join me and told them what I knew, so they could begin absorbing the fearful news and make plans, given their various commitments and schedules. I felt special concern for Ali and Haya, who had already lost one parent, and for whom Sidi was the absolute center of the world. I tried to convey the diagnosis in hopeful but honest terms, and it was not easy. I owed them the truth. "Do not sugarcoat it," I remember Haya telling me, as they all reeled from the news. Not until I was alone that night could I begin to allow the full extent of my own feelings to surface. I felt such fear, such bottomless anxiety at the thought of losing my husband, my best friend, my dearest love and inspiration, that it threatened to paralyze me. For 20 years we had been husband and wife, father and mother, life partners through international crises and domestic turmoil in Jordan. I had joined him with all my heart in his quest for peace in the region, and experienced with him every achievement and setback. Above all, we shared a love for Jordan and the goal of prosperity for all our beloved people. To lose this man would be a catastrophe on every level imaginable. He simply could not die. "Insha'Allah," we say in Arabic, "God willing." My husband believed, as Muslims do, that all things, both good and bad, come from God, and that God provides us the shoulders to carry that which we must. I shared that belief, and the underlying conviction that King Hussein was not meant to succumb to cancer. At that moment, I found the strength to still my panic over his diagnosis. God had willed him this battle with cancer, so we would fight it together. I would devote every fiber of my being to making my husband well and to protect him so that he could use all his energy to join the battle. "Dear God," I prayed that night, as I would every night and throughout the days for months to come, "please make him well. Please make him comfortable. Please give him strength, courage, and peace." Our prayers seem to have been answered when we met with Sidi's doctors the next day. The doctors were not yet sure whether he did indeed have cancer of the lymph glands, but even if he did, as they strongly suspected, the odds for his recovery were good. And so began our odyssey into an uncertain future, buoyed with the best that medicine could offer, the goodwill of the thousands of people who called, faxed, and sent cards and letters, and our own deepening faith, which would sustain us in the challenging months to come. The Mayo Clinic became our home, literally. The hospital had just completed a VIP suite that included a kitchen, a dining room, and a little room for me to sleep in next to his. The rest of our family and entourage stayed in a nearby hotel connected to the hospital by a tunnel. All of Hussein's children and various other family members came and went, with the exception of Hamza, who fortuitously was on a break between his graduation from Harrow and the beginning of his first term at Sandhurst. He rarely left his father's side. Hussein's happiest moments were spent with the children there, laughing and teasing his eldest daughter, Alia, his twins, Zain and Aisha, and Haya, who would have spent the entire time with us if they had not also had their own families to care for, and in Haya's case, a successful equestrian career. Somehow they managed both, cheering up their father tremendously throughout his ordeal, as did Ali, Hashim, Iman, and Raya, who came on every possible break from school, further lifting their father's spirits. Abdullah and his wife, Rania, and their two children visited, as did his younger brother, Faisal, and his wife, Alia, when the two brothers were able to take leave of their military responsibilities in Amman. Between cycles of chemotherapy, Hussein and I would fly to River House in Washington, or go on day trips around Minnesota in a silver Volkswagen Beetle I had bought for him shortly after our arrival. His treatment plan called for 6 courses of chemotherapy over 5 months, followed by a bone marrow transplant. Throughout this time, my husband's optimism never flagged. The doctors insisted that he had to rest to conserve his energy, which put me in a very difficult position. Knowing how exhausted he was from the treatment, it fell to me to try to monitor the amount of time he spent with his visitors. I became the gatekeeper. For all the agonies of those months, Hussein and I treasured every moment walking, talking, watching the flights of Canada geese through the big picture window, and taking in the small joys of life. Hussein became quite an avid birder at Mayo, something he had never had enough time for in Jordan, which is one of the greatest migratory routes in the world for more than 300 species of birds that pass through the rocky gorges of Dana, Mujib, and Petra, and the Azraq Oasis. It was in Minnesota that Hussein enjoyed some quiet moments to discover these pleasures himself. We went on one memorable outing in search of baby eagles. After our initial disappointment at not finding any on the lake where we had been told to look, we met 2 avid birdwatchers who led us to another vantage point. It was there, from a lay-by along the highway, that we trained our binoculars on a small island in the lake and saw the eagles nesting. We must have looked very odd from the road, both of us wearing face masks to prevent infection, looking through our long binoculars at no evident point of interest. But Hussein enjoyed it tremendously. We also traveled in the Silver Beetle to visit various Amish communities in Minnesota. One of our favorite destinations was the hilltop town of Harmony, Wisconsin, where we would admire the beautiful handmade Amish quilts. We would often stop for lunch, and Hussein would shake hands with anyone who approached him, while I worried about the risk of infection. He enjoyed driving the silver love bug so much that when I suggested we offer the beetle to a philanthropic organization to auction off when we left the hospital, he uncharacteristically said, "No, this is a very special car, and we are taking it home with us." I have it to this day. It was on one of those outings in the VW that my mobile phone rang, and we received the long-awaited thrilling news that on September 17, 1998, the African nation of Burkina Faso had become the 40th member of the United Nations to ratify the Ottawa Convention banning the use of landmines, thereby automatically putting the ban in force. We may have shattered the peaceful calm of the Minnesota countryside with our cheers. The treaty, the first international arms treaty to encompass humanitarian obligations to the weapons victims, was brought into force in record time through the unprecedented coalition activism of concerned governments, NGOs, and individuals united in a pledge to win back blighted land, to fulfill our humanitarian duties to the survivors, and to eradicate these insidious obstacles to recovery and peace. It had given me particular pride to inaugurate the first Middle East conference on landmines the day before our departure for Mayo, and to announce in my opening address Jordan's decision to sign and ratify the treaty, to destroy our landmine stockpiles, and to accelerate our effort, which had begun in 1993, to clear the minefields along Jordan's borders. Now we had taken another major step forward. During our breaks between courses of chemotherapy, C.D. and I also spent as much time as possible with the children, usually at River House. Iman was in a boarding school near Washington, D.C. At the last minute, we postponed Raya's return to school in Amman and brought her instead to the Merritt School in Washington, D.C., where her brother, Hashim, was in his senior year. It was a sudden and difficult adjustment for Raya, who was 12 at the time, and entering the 7th grade, but the school went out of its way to ease her transition, for which I will always be grateful. Hashim and Raya lived with my sister Alexa and her family in Washington, D.C. while we were at Mayo. All three would join the rest of us at River House during our respites there. It was difficult for the children to see their Baba so weak and suffering from nausea. One day, Iman called to say that she would have to miss part of one weekend with us at River House because she was participating in the National Coalition for Cancer Survivorship March, Coming Together to Conquer Cancer. After some thought, I contacted the organizers to see if we might contribute in some fashion, thinking that Hussein might be an inspiring voice to help dispel widespread taboos and fatal ignorance about the disease. Hussein's personal example and courage, I felt, might make a difference. The organizers were enthusiastic. The morning of the cancer rally, my husband awoke feeling somewhat weak and nauseous, but he insisted nonetheless on attending. Unfortunately, once there, we were taken to a hot, crowded, tented waiting area, where we were joined by the other speakers, Vice President Al Gore and his wife Tipper, General Norman Schwarzkopf, various members of Congress, and Cindy Crawford. Hussein felt weaker and weaker. I teased him that Cindy Crawford was taking his breath away, but as time passed and the temperature soared, he finally had to leave, asking me to speak for both of us, as I have continued to do every year since. There were other breaks when my husband felt quite well. During one of them we had an engaging evening with the Clintons at the White House, eating hamburgers outside on the Truman balcony. Hussein had developed a close working relationship with Bill Clinton. The Clintons shared our love for Harley Davidsons, so we sent Clinton an Annie Leibovitz photograph of us roaring around Wadi Rum on our Harley to remind the president of what he could look forward to at the end of his term. The talk that night was not about motorcycles, however, but about biological warfare and landmines. Hussein had just read with great interest Tom Clancy's book, Executive Orders, which describes a biological attack on the United States. We were discovering that many in the intelligence and national security community in Washington were quite certain that it was not a question of if, but when someone would launch such a terrorist attack against the United States. My husband discussed the book's realism, and then he turned to the subject of landmines to give me an opening to discuss the global Ottawa Landmine Ban Treaty. At the cancer event, even General Norman Schwarzkopf had offered support in our battle against landmines, as have many other senior retired U.S. military officers. The treaty has been signed by 143 countries, but still the United States is not among them, making it the only NATO member not banning these weapons, and the only Western holdout except Cuba. Cheering up their father tremendously throughout his ordeal, as did Ali, Hashim, Iman, and Raya, who came on every possible break from school, further lifting their father's spirits. Abdullah and his wife, Rania, and their two children visited, as did his younger brother, Faisal, and his wife, Alia, when the two brothers were able to take leave of their military responsibilities in Amman. Between cycles of chemotherapy, Hussein and I would fly to River House in Washington, or go on day trips around Minnesota in a silver Volkswagen Beetle I had bought for him shortly after our arrival. His treatment plan called for 6 courses of chemotherapy over 5 months, followed by a bone marrow transplant. Throughout this time, my husband's optimism never flagged. The doctors insisted that he had to rest to conserve his energy, which put me in a very difficult position. Knowing how exhausted he was from the treatment, it fell to me to try to monitor the amount of time he spent with his visitors. I became the gatekeeper. For all the agonies of those months, Hussein and I treasured every moment walking, talking, watching the flights of Canada geese through the big picture window, and taking in the small joys of life. Hussein became quite an avid birder at Mayo, something he had never had enough time for in Jordan, which is one of the greatest migratory routes in the world for more than 300 species of birds that pass through the rocky gorges of Dana, Mujib, and Petra, and the Azraq Oasis. It was in Minnesota that Hussein enjoyed some quiet moments to discover these pleasures himself. We went on one memorable outing in search of baby eagles. After our initial disappointment at not finding any on the lake where we had been told to look, we met two avid birdwatchers who led us to another vantage point. It was there, from a lay-by along the highway, that we trained our binoculars on a small island in the lake and saw the eagles nesting. We must have looked very odd from the road, both of us wearing face masks to prevent infection, looking through our long binoculars at no evident point of interest. But Hussein enjoyed it tremendously. We also traveled in the Silver Beetle to visit various Amish communities in Minnesota. One of our favorite destinations was the hilltop town of Harmony, Wisconsin, where we would admire the beautiful handmade Amish quilts. We would often stop for lunch, and Hussein would shake hands with anyone who approached him, while I worried about the risk of infection. He enjoyed driving the silver love bug so much that when I suggested we offer the beetle to a philanthropic organization to auction off when we left the hospital, he uncharacteristically said, "No, this is a very special car, and we are taking it home with us." I have it to this day. It was on one of those outings in the VW that my mobile phone rang, and we received the long-awaited thrilling news that on September 17, 1998, the African nation of Burkina Faso had become the 40th member of the United Nations to ratify the Ottawa Convention banning the use of landmines, thereby automatically putting the ban in force. We may have shattered the peaceful calm of the Minnesota countryside with our cheers. The treaty, the first international arms treaty to encompass humanitarian obligations to the weapons victims, was brought into force in record time through the unprecedented coalition activism of concerned governments, NGOs, and individuals united in a pledge to win back blighted land, to fulfill our humanitarian duties to the survivors, and to eradicate these insidious obstacles to recovery and peace. It had given me particular pride to inaugurate the first Middle East conference on landmines the day before our departure for Mayo, and to announce in my opening address Jordan's decision to sign and ratify the treaty, to destroy our landmine stockpiles, and to accelerate our effort, which had begun in 1993, to clear the minefields along Jordan's borders. Now we had taken another major step forward. During our breaks between courses of chemotherapy, C.D. and I also spent as much time as possible with the children, usually at River House. Iman was in a boarding school near Washington, D.C. At the last minute, we postponed Raya's return to school in Amman and brought her instead to the Marit School in Washington, D.C., where her brother, Hashim, was in his senior year. It was a sudden and difficult adjustment for Raya, who was 12 at the time, and entering the 7th grade, but the school went out of its way to ease her transition, for which I will always be grateful. Hashim and Raya lived with my sister Alexa and her family in Washington, D.C., while we were at Mayo. All three would join the rest of us at River House during our respites there. It was difficult for the children to see their Baba so weak and suffering from nausea. One day, Iman called to say that she would have to miss part of one weekend with us at River House because she was participating in the National Coalition for Cancer Survivorship March, Coming Together to Conquer Cancer. After some thought, I contacted the organizers to see if we might contribute in some fashion, thinking that Hussein might be an inspiring voice to help dispel widespread taboos and fatal ignorance about the disease. Hussein's personal example and courage, I felt, might make a difference. The organizers were enthusiastic. The morning of the cancer rally, my husband awoke feeling somewhat weak and nauseous, but he insisted nonetheless on attending. Unfortunately, once there, we were taken to a hot, crowded, tented waiting area, where we were joined by the other speakers, Vice President Al Gore and his wife Tipper, General Norman Schwarzkopf, various members of Congress, and Cindy Crawford. Hussein felt weaker and weaker. I teased him that Cindy Crawford was taking his breath away, but as time passed and the temperature soared, he finally had to leave, asking me to speak for both of us, as I have continued to do every year since. There were other breaks when my husband felt quite well. During one of them we had an engaging evening with the Clintons at the White House, eating hamburgers outside on the Truman balcony. Hussein had developed a close working relationship with Bill Clinton. The Clintons shared our love for Harley Davidsons, so we sent Clinton an Annie Leibovitz photograph of us roaring around Wadi Rum on our Harley to remind the president of what he could look forward to at the end of his term. The talk that night was not about motorcycles, however, but about biological warfare and landmines. Hussein had just read with great interest Tom Clancy's book, Executive Orders, which describes a biological attack on the United States. We were discovering that many in the intelligence and national security community in Washington were quite certain that it was not a question of if, but when someone would launch such a terrorist attack against the United States. My husband discussed the book's realism, and then he turned to the subject of landmines to give me an opening to discuss the global Ottawa Landmine Ban Treaty. At the cancer event, even General Norman Schwarzkopf had offered support in our battle against landmines, as have many other senior retired U.S. military officers. The treaty has been signed by 143 countries, but still the United States is not among them, making it the only NATO member not banning these weapons, and the only Western holdout except Cuba. The breaks at River House acted as a tonic for my husband. His appetite improved, and our chef supplied him with endless meals of hamburgers, steaks, and falafel sandwiches. Family members and various Jordanian officials arrived to discuss domestic and regional issues, as did U.S. officials and special guests, such as Crown Prince Abdullah bin Abdulaziz of Saudi Arabia, who made a special visit to see him, accompanied by Prince Saud al-Faisal, the Saudi foreign minister. The breaks at River House acted as a tonic for my husband. His appetite improved, and our chef supplied him with endless meals of hamburgers, steaks, and falafel sandwiches. Family members and various Jordanian officials arrived to discuss domestic and regional issues, as did U.S. officials and special guests, such as Crown Prince Abdullah bin Abdulaziz of Saudi Arabia, who made a special visit to see him, accompanied by Prince Saud al-Faisal, the Saudi foreign minister. The Crown Prince had brought my husband water from Mecca's sacred Zamzam well, which God created to save Ismail and Hagar from dying of thirst, and which has never dried up. The Saudi prince also brought a gift of saffron, believed to have curative powers. A sheikh recited verses of the Quran over the two gifts, and Prince Abdullah refused to let anyone but himself prepare the water and saffron. He put 2 teaspoons of saffron in a glass of Zamzam water, and attentively watched His Majesty drink it all, becoming quite emotional. The king was so deeply touched by the gesture of affection that he later wrote an emotional letter to Crown Prince Abdullah. During my husband's treatments at Mayo, nausea made it difficult for Hussein to eat anything. Sheikh Zayed and Sheikha Fatima of the United Arab Emirates spoiled us during much of our stay there by sending us enormous quantities of Arab delicacies, with the regular shipments of food and supplies they were sending a member of their family, who was also receiving treatment at Mayo at the same time. Extraordinarily generous, they kept in touch with us on a regular basis, as did Sultan Qaboos of Oman and his sister, Umayma bint Said, who, after his mother's death, had assumed her caring and generous style. We were the happy recipients of our favorite Arabic dishes and such delicacies as dates and Godiva chocolates, many of which found their way to the children's ward. Since my husband could not visit other patients at the hospital due to the risk of infection, I visited the children's ward as much as possible for both of us. Halloween was particularly memorable, bearing in mind how often my unspectacular appearance had disappointed children when they were introduced to the Queen. I found a large, elaborate Spanish hair comb with gold filigree and turquoise, shaped like a tiara, and I wore a long, flowing caftan. Attired in this way, I went to a party in the children's ward with our nurse, Burdette Rooney, who was swathed in bandages and telling the children she was the Queen's mummy. These visits may have meant more to their family members than they did to the courageous young patients. I had learned for myself that understanding, empathy, and a big hug are sometimes the most helpful support for those struggling with the horror of cancer-stricken loved ones. One of the renowned cancer specialists that Mayo had enlisted to consult on CD's case was Richard Klausner, director of the National Cancer Institute in Washington. I began discussions with him almost immediately about developing relations between NCI and our newly operational Al-Amal Cancer Center in Amman. Thousands of donations had poured in from Jordan and the region after Hussein's cancer scare in 1992, which enabled us to realize the long-planned project. The hospital, which had enormous potential to become a regional cancer center, was plagued by organizational and resource problems. Dr. Klausner and I were able to encourage an Arab-American oncologist and cancer researcher at NCI, National Institutes of Health, to work with us to develop a plan for an Al-Amal NCI partnership that would exchange expertise and medical personnel, as well as bring us valuable research and development and improvements to our clinical infrastructure, such as telemedicine links to NCI. My husband never stopped working during his stay at Mayo. A steady stream of government officials from Jordan came through, and he was in constant discussions on the telephone. Jordan was privatizing various institutions at the time, the most critical being the telecommunications network, and many companies were jockeying for position. Various people would attempt to contact the king and often ended up trying to get to him through me. Even while I was rollerblading on the trails around Rochester, my cellular phone would ring with interested parties persistently asking me to pass on a message to the king. I had little interest in anything but Hussein's health, and in trying to conserve his energy for that battle. But the world kept intruding. The amount of news coverage devoted to Washington scandals was appalling. "The television news cannot be a healthy therapy for him, but little else is on," I wrote in my journal. "It is sickening us while we are trying to heal." More disturbing were the rumors about Hussein's health that were finding their way into the international media. Our daughter Iman called the hospital in tears over a Time magazine article in October that essentially wrote off her father. I did not read that article, and tried to keep others at bay, because getting well was all that mattered. We certainly did not need to clutter our minds with wild speculation about Sidi's prognosis and intrigue over the succession to the throne. My husband was very much alive, and the doctors kept assuring us that the odds were good that he would win his battle with cancer. I rarely left Hussein's side, except at his insistence. He urged me to travel to New York in October to announce the 40th ratification of the Landmine Treaty at the United Nations, which also gave me some time to spend with one of our favorite persons, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, who was warm, wise, and supportive, as ever, and stayed in close touch with my husband throughout his hospitalization. Sidi also insisted that I go through with laser eye surgery that had been scheduled for August with a brilliant pioneering eye surgeon in Jordan, surgery that I had cancelled. The ophthalmic specialist at Mayo recommended a doctor in Atlanta, George Waring, who performed the procedure under the supervision of my Jordanian doctor, Khalid Sharif. I ended up having to undergo the procedure twice, and I never quite achieved 20/20 vision, but my sight improved tremendously, and I was able to stop wearing prescription lenses much of the time. My husband was fascinated by the new laser technology, and he delighted in going through the whole process vicariously with me, even watching a video of the procedure, which I could not bear to see myself. It was very difficult for Hussein to accept his dependence on others because of his weakened condition, even though he was an extremely undemanding patient. Over and over he would apologize for the trouble he was causing us, and over the children and I would respond that we would not be happier doing anything else. We tried throughout to reassure him that there was no greater privilege in life for us than being with him in sickness and in health, and it was absolutely true. As long as I had known Hussein, he had said he would never want to be a burden on anyone as he grew older. And here he was, a relatively young man of 62, already feeling he had become exactly that. The truth was quite the opposite. In fact, he was a constant source of strength and inspiration for all of his family, his friends, and even the Mayo Clinic staff. Soon after we arrived at Mayo, I had bought my husband a gift of ruby cufflinks and studs for his birthday. I had chosen them because rubies are traditionally considered to be healing stones. The children and I started a ritual of sorts, during which we would stand around his bed and gently touch his